Welcome to Thinking Out Loud, the podcast that puts you inside conversations with the most deeply passionate, intensely dedicated, and yes, the most thoughtful people in our industry. So sit back and stay tuned. They may just change the way you think.
Hello, I'm Vicki Lins, President and CEO of CTAM, a marketing organization focused on media, entertainment, and technology. And today I'm talking with Johnny Keeling, executive producer of BBC America's new nature docuseries, Seven Worlds, One Planet. Welcome.
Thank you.
The show is premiering across four networks, across BBC America, IFC, AMC, and Sundance, simultaneously. So it's not really targeting any particular audience. It's targeting a very broad audience of interest. What is it you're hoping to achieve by connecting with viewers?
Well, I think everyone can relate to the natural world. You can be 5 years old or 95 years old. And we make this programming is for the whole family. It's for everyone. I think that's important. I love the fact it's on four networks. It feels like a vote of confidence from people who have given us the money to go and make these films, which is great. I hope that people watch it and that they fall in love with the natural world, particularly about their own continent. You know, if you're from North America and you think, well, I've seen it all. It's all studied. It's a well-documented continent. I defy you not to be surprised. So it's just remarkable. There are sequences like that throughout the North America episode and throughout every episode, which are surprising. And I want people to come away and think, I never knew that, and be blown away by it.
Historically, the network brand has always played a role in setting people's expectations for what they're going to view. But AMC is very different from IFC, from Sundance, and from BBC America. I'm not sure that network brand plays the same role in teeing up viewer expectations. So what does that look like when you're putting something like this program out there and you're putting it through such different channels?
I'm not an expert at the channels. I leave that to the expert and the colleagues in BBC America and AMC who deal with that, and they do a great job. All I know is that we have to just tell the very best stories, and that those stories will be compelling. It doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter what your social background is, what channel you're watching it on. If they are compelling, emotional stories about the natural world, people will come to them wherever they are.
And it gives you a very big opportunity to have a voice in this mm-hmm. space. So you're clearly trying to entertain people. You're trying to inform them. You're also trying to educate them. Is this series a vehicle for raising awareness, sensitivity, and hopefully action around what's happening to our world and to the natural world around us?
Yeah, it is. I mean, what I want people to do is watch it, fall in love with the natural world, and then decide they might want to do something to help the natural world. But within the episode, we do not preach to people. We do not wave a finger and say, you should have done this, or you should do that, or go and do this. All we do is we document the natural world. So we say, here are the facts, here are the images, here's Sir David Attenborough's wonderful voice. Now you go and decide what you want to do. We don't tell anyone what to do. But of course, inside, I hope that people love the program, love animals, love nature, and then decide that they'll do something at home to make a difference, because we need to. We're at a point in the natural world now where if we don't do something in the next few years, then there are serious consequences. We're seeing those happen now.
We talk a lot in the media industry about how consumers are now in control. They're consuming content very differently on different devices, different access points. What effect does that have on nature documentaries? It's hard for me to imagine somebody watching Seven Worlds, One Planet on a mobile phone. It's not designed for that.
No, but they do. I mean, some of the kids in the UK certainly watched it on their phones. Some of the audience in China, we get 250 million people in China watching our shows as well.
So knowing that, does it impact the creative process? Does it change how you perceive this big, bold footage that you're capturing?
No, because you have to make it. So some people will watch it on a big screen. I mean, sometimes it's screened in a cinema, in a theater, and you have to make it so it can be, you know, so you can tell a story at a huge level or on a tiny mobile phone. I think the most important thing is the story. It's the same with everything, really. If the story is good, it will work on a mobile phone and it will work on a giant screen as well. So you've got to tell a really compelling story.
How much of this series is educating viewers on climate change and the effects on wildlife and nature overall versus the compelling storytelling in the moment life of animals type of nature documentary that we're more accustomed to?
I would say most of it is celebrating the variety and the wonder of each continent and the animals that live there. But you can't have a story, an episode about Antarctica without talking about climate change. We don't repeat that story across every continent. But I mean, if you think there's, say, 9 or 10 sequences in each episode, then probably 7 or 8 of those will be animal and animal behavior and pure sort of drama of that animal, how it survives in that environment. And then 1 or 2 of them may be stories of conservation. But generally, if you watch each episode, you will get a really good sense of the animals that live on that continent. And it's the drama and emotion of those animal lives that will really draw you in.
So the obvious question is, what makes Seven Worlds, One Planet different from other nature documentaries?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I worked on Planet Earth 1 and Planet Earth 2, and I wanted to tell a different story here. So it's separated by continent. Those previous series were separated by habitat. So they had an episode on jungles, on mountains, on deserts. And I wanted to talk about real places because it's quite difficult. If you're watching a show about mountains and you're sort of dotting around the world, you don't know where you are. I wanted to make sure that we knew where we are. I wanted it to relate to the audience. We all come from a continent. We don't all come from a desert or a mountain. We all come from a continent. So, you know, when you're watching the North America show, you can say, oh yeah, I understand. It's a real place. And it also means that you get extraordinary variety within an episode. So you're able to have amazing variety within a single episode. And so that was one way that it was very different from all previous series. We've never broken up the world in this sort of continental jigsaw that we do.
Do you go to each continent with specific goals in mind of what you want to try to capture? Or do you go and then let the footage drive the story because what you capture dictates the stories you have to tell?
Well, it's mainly that we plan very carefully for each sequence. We do a lot of research. We spend a year doing the research. The whole project takes 4 years. The first year, we're doing the research, digging out stories. Then we spend 2 years filming, knowing what we're going to do, where we're going to film it, how it's going to happen. There's 1,500 people that we work with around the world. So it's a big group of scientists and field workers. We did 91 expeditions to 41 countries, and we filmed for nearly 1,800 days. For every episode, we filmed more than 300 hours for a 1 hour episode. So we know what we're going to do and we know how we're going to do it. But when you get there, of course, animals don't read the script. They don't know what they're doing and they just do whatever they want. That means sometimes you can have, you know, it can be worse than you thought, but quite often they'll do something really extraordinary, better than you ever thought. So if you give yourself the time, it's all about time in the field. That's why we'd spend 4 years doing it, because we want to make something that's really high quality, something that's surprising and new for the audience. And you can only do that if you spend many, many weeks on location.
I have 2 questions for you about time.
Yes.
You mentioned that it took 4 years to produce this show, and you've also been in this business now for 25 years. So my related questions are, did you see change happen within that 4-year window that you were able to capture or integrate into the story? And what changes have you seen in the course of your 25-year career doing this that's making it different now to do this type of work?
I mean, in the 4 years, I didn't really notice changes on location, because quite often we would go to one place and just be there, film, and then come back. Sometimes we'd go back twice, but usually maybe within a year. So you don't necessarily notice much. I think the way that we tell stories, there's a lot more drama involved. Before, they were quite sort of factually based, and it was this animal does this, it does that, and that's it. We still have that layer, but we also now have a layer of drama. And often we're trying to follow one character, one animal, and follow the life of that. So I think that's important. The music is Hans Zimmer, and that's something that's new. This series we have more, it's more realistic. In Planet Earth 1, we didn't talk about conservation or anything. If you watch it, it doesn't have that. And this series has all the beauty and wonder of Planet Earth, but it also has some of the realism, and I think that's important. So that's a big change. Technology has changed. We use drones now. We're able to capture behavior that we've never seen before by taking drones. We took them all over the world. We took them through caves in Europe, through volcanoes at night in Asia. We took them through icebergs in Antarctica. I mean, everywhere.
So have you shifted from working with a camera person to a drone pilot? What does that skill set look like? And how does that change the approach you take, knowing that you can now insert yourself into spaces that really were previously unavailable to us?
Well, we still need to take the brilliant camera operators. But we've also, on this series, employed guys who are very good with drones. One of the guys, he's also a very good photographer on sort of ground level too. So he was a valuable asset because he could go, we could be filming on the ground and then say, actually, today is a drone day, or let's fly the drone this afternoon, and he can go and fly that too. So he's sort of multi-skilled approach.
How did you determine what drone footage would be best to capture and what on-the-ground footage would be best? And
well, when you go on location, because the drones are so small and portable, you can just take it with you. I mean, you can put it in your backpack. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the great thing. You don't have to have a helicopter waiting on standby, which is hugely expensive, often impossible as well if you're in the middle of Antarctica. But if you've got your drone there, suddenly something starts to happen. Your drone can be up in 2 minutes and be hovering, you know.
Does it allow you to get closer to the animals in a different way, in a less threatening way? Does it enable you to insert viewers into more of the actual experience?
Yeah, I think it does. The drones are quiet enough now. Not all of them. I mean, some of them, you know, when you hear a drone taking off, I don't know if you stood next to one, but it can make a kind of quite a whining sound. But once they're up in the air and the wind may be blowing and we've got longer lenses on them now, and they're good lenses, good cameras, nice and stable as well.
So how much of this is instinct? Is your gut telling you that you're going to spend extra time in this particular place or on that particular animal because you can just tell that something's going to happen or that there'll be something of interest versus just following the script, following the plan, and if you're lucky, great.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because actually a lot of it is instinct, but it's instinct born out of years and years of work and experience. So when you're on location, you just think, I just think it's going to happen. We need to spend another week here, or I've got a feeling that if we move now, we need to go to the other side of this bay or whatever, and we'll get it there. So you're assimilating all of that information, and then you're using that to kind of trust, we often say, trust your gut. You know, I mean, everyone says that, but it's really important in this that you do that.
How much does your academic training come into play in the finished product and what you're able to capture and bring to the storytelling?
Well, I mean, the scientific integrity and the factual integrity of the program is really important. But the emotion of the story is really key as well. We want to tell, you know, a story like a drama, really, you know, in the same way with the ups and downs. Animals' lives reflect our lives. They fall in love. They fear things. They bring up their young. They break up. There's all sorts of things that happen in animals' lives. And we want that to be, you know, reflected so that people can empathize with that.
Your love for all of this clearly comes through. So thank you so much for sitting down and sharing all of that with us today.
Thanks a lot.
Hope you found this Thinking Out Loud conversation interesting and perhaps even thought-provoking. There are more on the way. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave a review.